listening to the Colorado Springs Real Estate Investing Podcast, brought to you by the Envision Advisors at Your Castle Real Estate.
Hey everyone, Chris Lopez here, and we have another Ask the Investor episode with myself and Jenny Bayless. Today, we're going to be talking with a house hacker on how to plan on purchasing house hack number 3, and we'll loop in some strategy here. Is it best to save? Is it best to sell an out-of-state rental property? Or is it best to dip into and repurpose the Roth IRA funds? So great discussion here. And my co-host is Jenny. And as a forewarning, Jenny's losing her voice. So Jenny is waving. She'll be talking some, but we'll keep you on light duty, Jenny.
Thanks.
But our investor in the hot seat is our very own Ben Einspar. And I think most of our listeners know who you are, Ben. But if you don't, Ben is an active house hacker here in Denver, owns some properties out of state. And also, as a couple of months ago, he made a huge career transition of going from his W-2 job, not real estate, over to working as the house hacking specialist at Envision Advisors, which is just a great another resource for our clients here at Envision Advisors. And one last thing with that career change, that does change lending options. So we talk about that too. Ben, how are you?
Excellent, Chris. Great introduction.
You like that one?
I love it. All right. That was awesome. And it's good to be on the other side. I'm not hosting the Masterminds podcast.
So let's jump into this. I know you're playing on house hack number 3, but there are really 3 things before we say, hey, how do you buy house hack 3? We have to back it up, get a 10,000 foot level view. And really, you know, it's understanding market conditions. It's understanding your current portfolio and also understanding your basically your current personal financial situation as well. Market, we don't need to drill down about that, but portfolio and your personal situation we do. So let's start with your portfolio.
Portfolio. So on a high level, I have 3 rental properties right now that consist of about 4 doors. First property is an out-of-state rental that I'll call an accidental landlord in Omaha, Nebraska. I bought it in late 2016, and I have about $85,000 in equity, which has been really great. But however—
Wait, when did you buy it?
Late 2016.
Well, okay.
So if you look at this property on a profit and loss statement base, just cash flow from rent versus mortgage, PITI, and expenses, I'm losing money. But we've been very lucky with appreciation. I'm gaining on it, so I want to hold that as long as possible.
But those issues aren't just from paying the bills. You've had a lot of like CapEx maintenance, right? That's part of it. Like roof, fence, some water damage.
Roof, water, fence.
Yeah.
Yeah, here and there, which is expected with being a landlord.
But it all just happened at once, which eats from the cash flow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just want to mention that too, because it's not just, that's been a big part. If that didn't happen, would it be negative cash flowing?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No, not at all.
What would it would cash flow? 100, 500 bucks, 1,000 bucks, just a ballpark.
A month?
Yeah, or a year.
200 bucks okay. A month. I mean, I have my rent about 100 bucks below market. No, I'll say about 150 below market value because I have good tenants in there, and good tenants make a good rental property, and they've been in there for 4 years. Yeah. So I really work with them, and it eliminates having to deal with a turnover from out of state, yeah. Which I do the property management. I don't want to deal with the turnover.
And those are, I mean, vacancies kill NOI. And I have never turned a property out of state, but I imagine it's not the easiest thing to do.
You have to get creative.
Yeah. Okay, so you got that property. Now, I think the rest are your properties here in Denver.
Correct. The first house hack closed in April of 2019. It is a 4-bedroom, 3-bath house with a mother-in-law suite. The mother-in-law suite I'm currently renting out, it was an Airbnb when we lived there. I'm renting out as a medium-term rental to traveling nurses. And the main level is on a 24-month lease, and I'm about halfway through to a nice family that is flexible. And I was upfront with them when vetting them and letting them know, hey, we're going to have some turnovers in the mother-in-law, and they were completely cool with it. So it made a great win-win. Cool. And Denver market's excellent. So I have excellent appreciation in that property as well.
And you said you're conservatively about 175.
Yes.
Okay. House hack number two.
Current primary residence right now. New build townhome in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. With a little income suite on the first level that my wife and I are operating as an Airbnb. Great Airbnb, makes it perfect. And again, with the great market conditions, I'm seeing great great equity in that property as well.
All right. So I know for both those house hacks, we've done podcasts on there. So we should put links in the show notes. If you guys want the exact details on there and more story behind them, go check it out. But great overview. So, I mean, you're sitting on, $300,000 in total equity. Congratulations. What, 1,000 plus a month cash flow altogether on average?
Yeah. I like to put, with the career transition, I like to be very conservative on how much I hold back and how much I actually recognize on profit. So, $1,000. Let's just call it that to be easy.
Good. So, I mean, a very, very solid portfolio with some options and a great foundation. So kind of shifting from portfolio, let's kind of just take a step back and go back to, you and Allison, your wife and your partner and all this. What's the long-term goal? And then let's kind of loop back to like lending and some timelines.
Long-term goal would be house hack number three around in about 2 years. And 2 years because I just made a career transition from a W-2 job to working with Envision, and that was known. And the great thing about rental property investing is it's a great long-term investment. So whether you're investing every 12 months or 24 months, in my personal opinion, it's still a great win-win. So it would be house hacking about two years, and then living it for a little 2+ years. Because we have a family and we have a great portfolio, and we'll kind of reevaluate as we go there. Then maybe let's say 5-6 years, we'll go to house hack number four.
All right. So you're on about a 2-year trajectory for Nomad, Nomad / house hacks.
Correct.
And so something to talk about as well on the finance. You mentioned like you were very heads up thinking and being aware that, hey, you're going from a W-2 to a 1099 in different career fields. So that, kind of starts you at zero again at many lenders' perspectives. But jumping forward, because we'll come back to this, because that it sounds like that works for your family. And realistically, you'll probably be 2 years out to get like a solid loan so you can show those 2 years of good income statements. Now, with this said, if you are 2 years out, your cash flow and equity is only going to increase by then. I mean, you may be sitting on, $400,000 in equity by then, maybe even more than that. And you start getting some really crazy numbers here. And I know this is hard to look at 2 years in advance, but we'll do the best we can here. Your three main options are save, the down payment, and I think we were estimating, $45,000 or so for all in on your next house hack?
That I'm anticipating for all in cash invested into my next house hack, about $45,000.
Okay, about $45,000. Because this will be your, fourth rental property. So, first-time home buyer programs, grant programs are probably going to be out of there. So we're assuming a 5% down conventional loan, right?
Yeah. Correct.
So 5% down the purchase price plus some closing costs. There's always a few bucks to help the property get going. Now comes down to the question, and this is going to be fun debating you, Jenny, as best you can with your voice. Do you save? Do you tap into your Roth or do you tap into your equity? You want to start, Jenny?
No, you go for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm a big fan of you're at the point as you start getting properties, you have equity. And that is, in my view, equity is untapped money in your real estate piggy bank. And so I would always personally rather use that over cash to go out there and buy a property. Just because there's opportunity cost with cash, cash is liquid, and reinvesting equity. I mean, we've talked about this on podcasts in the past, that your equity grows, your return actually starts dropping because you have so much money in your real estate piggy bank. So to keep those high double-digit returns that we like to see in real estate, we have to keep your equity working for you. So I lean towards using equity over cash, especially since you have so much of it. I would put equity first on there to tap into. And we can go through some scenarios on there, because you could go through, like, I mean, on your house hack number one, I mean, you could probably do a cash out refi, but you will then do like an investment loan and lose probably a good down payment or a good interest rate on there. But you have so much equity, you might be able to throw a HELOC on there, even as an investment property, and pull out some money on there.
Both of this, are you saying combined?
No, I would do one or the other.
One, okay, this is not my expertise. That's why I'm reaching out to the experts here and I have to ask the questions.
So,
yeah, I was just going to say, for an investment property HELOC, typically the loan to value is not as beneficial if it was your primary home, but it's still definitely worth tapping into, especially if you have a really good loan on your property right now. And if you were to cash out, refinance it into that investment 30-year fixed loan, and you would kind of lose some of the benefits, you know, loan to value and interest rate in that case. So a HELOC would be an investment HELOC would be an interesting approach to speaking with a banker on that, I think. Yeah.
And I looked at HELOCs earlier this year, I think a lot of banks don't do investment property HELOCs. The best quote I got was like a 70% LTV for a HELOC on there. Cash out refis would be like a 75%. But you know, that resets your term, your monthly payment on there as well. So the other thing too, looking forward in 2 years, your Wheat Ridge house hack, which I know this was a new build complex, and you're one that I think the first ones to buy in there, looking at what other new builds are going for. You're sitting on a lot of equity, and you'll continue growing equity.
Yep.
So you could look at a cash out refi to go get a lot more cash out of your potential route of house hack. But you also might be able to do a HELOC on your current Wheat Ridge property as a primary. So that's your primary.
Yep.
And I mean, banks will go up to 90 to 95% LTV on HELOCs. So even if you have still 80% loan to value on your purchase price based on your loan and what's depreciated, you might be able to get 10 to 15% more equity off that.
Okay.
And it'd be higher leverage, but you're going to be, you know, when I got quotes like, those type of primary personal HELOCs for like high 3%, investments for like in the 5% HELOCs. So you'll get a better LTV and a better interest rate as well.
So how does that look? Because right now I'm living in it and I'm getting a primary residence, you said HELOC, right? And then I go and I move out and now that's not my primary residence anymore. I move into another one. Does a lender not care about that? Am I understanding that correctly?
No, because you're telling them, hey, right now it's my primary residence.
Right now, correct.
And that's what they, you know, that. And for HELOCs, it's totally different rules and like, there's no 1 year requirement commitment that I've seen. I would double check that, but I've not seen that for HELOCs.
Yeah.
Have you?
No.
So you would have, say, hey, it's my primary residence. And then what you can do is you can draw the money out of that HELOC, put into your checking account, and then use that for your down payment on house hack number three.
Okay.
Now, what you want to do there is talk with, you know, not the HELOC banker, but the lender doing your loan on house hack number three to say, hey, if I make this and I pull this money out, that is going to raise your debt. And that may have an impact on your debt to income ratio, which may have an impact on you qualifying for the loan. So there's a little bit of a chess game here to like tease out. That's something you want to talk about. Hey, if it lines up, awesome. That can be an amazing way to do it. So I would look at like HELOCs or cash out refis, and kind of depending on the time, again, we're in forecasting out here in the future, you know, your property will change, interest rates will change, the market will change. But like in today's environment, that's what I would like, that's where my gut goes to.
So your gut goes to, capitalizing on equity and rental properties.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now to kind of go down the next route, you know, I could make the case that, hey, in another year or 2 years about a house hack, it might make the most sense to sell.
To sell which one?
Your Avada one. It depends. You have to run the numbers, but with how much appreciation you've gotten on there, again, it comes down to the numbers and how the current performance of it is. I'm saying it's good to look at the spreadsheet, because sometimes the spreadsheet says, hey, to maximize return, you do sell and reposition it. But yeah. I don't think that's what you want to do.
No.
Based on your facial expression. Yeah.
If you're watching the video, the picture tells it all.
Is that how you play poker?
Yeah, that's why I don't play poker. That's why I was terrible at poker in high school.
I can see the gears turning up there.
No, because, okay, so I have my property and I'm selling it. I'm not capitalizing on the 1031 exchange because I'm not transitioning that into an investment property. And correct me if I'm wrong, I'm transitioning it into a primary residence. So now I'm taking the hit on the...
Not necessarily.
Okay.
It depends on timing, because to exclude capital gains, you have to live in the property two out of the last five years.
Okay. Which is a negative.
Okay.
Which I haven't. I lived in there 1.5 years.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, that's off the table then.
Yes.
Well, can I just throw something out there? So if you're sitting on $175,000 worth of equity, like just spitballing here, you could take that and then 1031 it into a fourplex in Colorado Springs.
Okay.
So now you're taking one unit or, you know, two units, because that's your mother-in-law, one.
Yeah.
And then putting it into four doors now. So as a straight investment property, like it doesn't necessarily have to be house hack to house hack or former house hack to, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So one of my big things is I like to focus on one thing that I'm good at and stick to it. And what I'm good at is house hacking. Am I chasing a shiny object by, hey, I have
no. I mean, you're right. You're good at house hacking. Like house hacking is your bread and butter for acquiring properties at a very low down payment, reducing your living expenses and getting your foot in the door on there. But as this property appreciates, Wheatwood appreciates, house number three appreciates, you fast forward a couple years, you're going to be selling on $500,000 worth of equity. You have turned that house hack, low down payment, sweat equity into probably $500,000 portfolio in equity, $500,000 equity portfolio in a couple years. You could keep house hacking, but you know most people can only house hack a nomad so long until they get fatigued, they want to settle down. Secondly, it gets to the point where it's just like, it is such a huge amount of your net worth that is not being positioned well, and you're making 8%, 10% of that money, re-leverage up and go buy bigger properties, which are still rental properties. You're just acquiring them a different way. So it kind of comes down to, it is a mindset shift. And there are risks involved, but it has an amazing way to trade up. I mean, I use example time. Like, you know, I bought my first house hack in 2011 or whatever. 8 years later, I sold it, 1031 it, and bought a fourplex. Okay. Same thing that Jenny is recommending, except yours is going to take half the time I did. For the equity.
Yeah. Build. And you know, you put what, 5% down on that house
probably.
So you just leveraged, you know, 5%, whatever you know, I don't know what you purchased it for, but 5% down for that. And now you might be sitting on like a $700,000 asset after that. Like that's pretty amazing.
That's the great thing. Cause I had a narrow mindset on just Omaha property. What am I going to do with my Omaha property? But I didn't think about my Arvada house hack on capitalizing on that large amount of equity that I'm sitting on.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know we're kind of like, and again, this is just how these, you know, portfolio reviews go. It's just kind of like, you just start, oh, you could do this, you could do this, you could do this. But this is what we need to talk about to understand, hey, which door do you want to go through? And from a pure return standpoint, it's going to be tapping your equity. That's what the spreadsheet always says. Either through a cash out refi or a sell and trade up, your equity is always going to give you the highest return. Vast majority of time. But then, looping back to Omaha, because I know that was actually kind of the big property we want to talk about, and we've not mentioned it yet.
Yeah, that's just a friction point because it's an out-of-state rental. I'm the property management. It's not making me money on a spreadsheet standpoint, but it's making me money through equity. And just how to eliminate that friction from my life so I can focus on other things and capitally making that money work for me as hard as it can into something else, into a market I'm more familiar with. And that's what.
And so, and I definitely want to talk about that. I just want to start with those Denver properties, because you said something on there too, is like, it's a friction point.
Yes.
It's out of state. And so, you know, there's nothing wrong with like, hey, you sell the rental properties that are just like, hey, it's the dog of my portfolio. And that's just a natural, you gotta call the herd, right? Hey, this, for whatever variety of factors, the main one, probably don't live there anymore. It's a pain in the butt. So that I would definitely look at probably selling in 1031 with the friction point, like line things up timeline wise, tenant wise, so tenants are out there because you want to sell that property vacant, updated, remodeled to an owner occupant, at least in the current market conditions, that's going to get you top dollar. I'm assuming Omaha is going to be similar. And then 1031 that into a rental property.
Okay.
I will not take the tax it for your house hack because you're not going to be paying the tax it. You'll be paying also depreciation recapture if you've taken depreciation write-offs. And I don't know the exact percent on there, but it adds up on paying back a property, right, Jenny?
Yeah.
What's the rate? It's like...
It's 25% on depreciation recapture.
Okay. Before you ever sell a property, like anywhere close to selling a rental property, talk to your CPA and have them like, you know, run some scenarios for you. But that, I don't see that being a good use for your house hack property. Because if that equity, you probably don't have enough to like really pull out any significant amount of cash, if any, based on just loan to value ratios. Because you'll be at the 70-75% LTV out there, just like you are in Denver. That's a pretty standard lending rule. So pulling equity under there for a house hack from like a cash out refi is going to be very tough. Selling it, not doing a 1031 to then pay a bunch of taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Why pay tax when you have to? Hold on to that. And as timing lines up, your lending and your career gets on next level, I would then 1031 somewhere else into like, you know, somewhere where you live and you know, I'm assuming your guys' plans are Denver for the long run, right? Yeah. Do it somewhere here.
Okay. So what I'm getting from you is the best leverage is equity. With a 1031, is there any option I have with combining the equity of Omaha Rental and House Hack Number 1 into a multi-unit in Colorado Springs?
Yes, but it will be very difficult to time it.
Yeah. Because you can sell them both. But then the 1031 rules, you have to sell, identify in 45 days, and close. So you have to line them up so they're both hopefully selling around the same time. And then they sell and you take the money and roll in the same property. So it's just more stars to line up. So the more properties involved in 1031, just the more complicated it gets. Because what happens, hey, great, they're both under contract, they're both doing well. And then on your Arada property, the buyer... whatever reason, their loan falls out 5 days before closing. Well, something. What do you do?
Something is going to go wrong.
That's what you'll be saying.
It is going to go wrong. What about a reverse 1031 exchange?
That can be cost prohibitive, depending on how much gain you're actually working with here.
Yeah.
And the QIs, they're very helpful in helping you figure out, hey, is it worth doing this method or not.
What do you mean QI?
So qualified intermediary is who you have to work with
for a 1031. Okay.
Yep. You may not touch the sales proceeds or else it's going to get taxed. So the QI.
It's in their bank account.
Yeah. They have an escrow account. Yep.
Okay.
Exactly. So, and because they're facilitating the exchange, you know, that's who you're paying to do that. So if you're going to do a reverse 1031, the QI is who you are paying to facilitate that exchange as
well.
That's
really good to know.
Yeah. So speak with them.
And the other thing too, aside from it does cost more money, like usually like five times the amount of a regular 1031 as a ballpark I've gathered.
Okay.
You also have to figure out what money you're going to use to purchase the next property, because that money has to come from somewhere. You probably don't have $300,000 cash put down on a property. So then you're either going to borrow it from, a bank's not going to be 100% loan. Some QIs have funding connections. Some people use hard money lenders. You have to, a lot of times, get some type of bridge financing in there to say, hey, great, I got $300,000 here that I'm about to sell, but I need to put $300,000 over here.
Not going
to
happen.
There are options out there from like third-party lenders. So it's worth talking about.
Yeah.
But folks, on those things, a lot of people talk about it, but very few people do because it just doesn't make sense.
A nightmare. Yeah. I mean,
unless you have the very, very big properties, like a different, like, you know, we're talking like, you know, $1 million plus multifamilies and bigger properties. Numbers are different. Lending is different. Options are different.
Yeah. Chris's motto, keep it simple. I mean, I would just do one at a time.
Okay.
Yep.
That's very good.
And again, that's as it comes up, you always reevaluate, depends on market conditions. Like, again, today's market, a lot more tough. Hopefully things have cooled off in 2 years. But I would definitely, like I said, priority one is I would tap on your equity. And I kind of want to loop back and actually talk about the Roth IRA? Because this is a fascinating debate.
As well.
Anything else you guys want to talk about on the equity side?
No, that's extremely insightful. That side of it, I never thought about even being in the real estate world.
And you know this, Ben. Like, I mean, you know, we do the portfolio analysis, help people figure out how to optimize or equity their portfolio. We would, when as time gets a little closer, we'll run everything through there and, you know, put numbers on there and get more detailed. But that's very much like a high level and the mindset I'd be working towards.
Okay.
Yep. And then for the pure rental properties that you'd be exchanging into, I know that lending is kind of a sticky subject right now, just with your job change and everything. I know that we were talking about it a little bit earlier this week, but you know, there are loan options that I think are worth exploring, and you can kind of figure out like opportunity costs in that case. So like non-QM loans, which goes based off of the asset performance, is going to be less favorable terms, maybe like lower amortization schedule or higher interest rate. But you know, if you want to kind of lock into prices that I assume are going to keep rising over the next 2 years, that might be worth considering. And then you could always refinance it once you get your, you know, job history.
Yeah, in that's place. A great point as well.
Yeah,
yeah, I love that idea too, because again, it just comes down to, you know, you said writing the trends, identifying it. Because I mean, I've never done it personally. I'm on emails. I've looked down. We've had a few clients to them. I mean, a lot of times they're in like that 5 to 7% range in interest rate.
Mm-hmm.
And then they usually like a 3 to 7 year ARM. So it'll be amortized over 25 or 30 years, but then you have an adjustable rate mortgage, you know, that resets after 5 years. And so most people, they plan on selling or refinancing before that fixed interest rate term comes up. So it's exactly what Jenny was, the play would be like, hey, does it make sense for me to take out a higher interest rate loan to go out here and do this? And then, you know, over the next 1 to 2 years, as your lending comes up, or you're, you know, you're you get a better lending profile, then you can go out there and refinance into a you know, better interest rate product. There are some risks involved there as well, because hey, if something happens on lending, you can't do it, or interest rates rise dramatically, or there are risks there as well. But it's another thing to think about.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yep.
I personally probably wouldn't do that, just because if you keep doing what you're doing, this is like, you know, you're going to have success this way. Right. To kind of like be conservative.
Yeah. I like keeping it simple and not being too aggressive, because it's a long term game I'm playing here that I've learned. And sometimes the risks aren't worth the reward, and focus on other things.
But it's worth looking at, or for a lot of, you know, other listeners out there who are in similar situations.
Absolutely.
They can be a great, we're like, hey, on the spreadsheet, it's the best thing in the world to do something like that. Because like, hey, I get an asset. Yeah, I'm paying a few more dollars in interest right now, but in the long run, it's actually a really good wealth builder.
Yeah.
So there can be situations where it makes a ton of sense, because it's basically just a longer term bridge finance.
Yeah.
So the Roth IRA.
Let's hear it. Let's start.
You guys can correct me if I'm incorrect on here, but you know, Roth IRAs, they are retirement accounts. And generally speaking, any principal you put in, so if I put $5,000 a year, you know, over 5 years, and I have $25,000 principal in there, but I have an extra $10,000 in earnings, you're able to withdraw your principal, the money you've put in there, and pay no taxes, no early termination fees. Right?
Yep.
Okay.
That's how I understand it too.
Yeah. So I have very mixed emotions about that.
Let's hear it.
So high level, again, if equity, I tap on equity first.
Okay.
The thing about Roth IRAs is, I'm assuming it's a standard Roth where it's invested in stocks and bonds.
Correct.
So you're getting, you know, hey, you're in this year, hey, you're getting the 15%, 10% return, you're getting the average stock market return. So good returns, but we know historically speaking, those returns are nothing like a leveraged real estate return, especially like a leveraged house hack return at 5% down. So yes, from a standpoint of you take the $45,000 out of there. Let's just say $50,000. You take $50,000 out of there in principal for down payment. You're making a better return, but the other part of me has an incredibly hard time of pulling money out of, you know, of a vehicle that it can compound in there tax free. at that point. You've paid taxes going in, and presumably you put money in there when you're at a younger, lower tax bracket rate. So hopefully you're getting, you know, some arbitrage there. I have a very hard time pulling money out of that when you can have that compound tax-free for the rest of your life. But at the same time, get a higher return in real estate, and we can make the same case that, hey, if you keep 1031-ing and swapping till you're dropping, assuming that there's no huge changes in 1031 rules, that you might be able to avoid paying tax on that money as well.
Okay.
So that's my mixed emotions. No advice. I'm curious about Jenny, but that's where I am feeling right now.
I'm very torn on this subject. Like, emotionally, it just feels like wrong, but not.
Yes, that's the right word.
But wrong pulling it. I want to make sure.
Wrong pulling it out.
Okay.
But
okay.
Mathematically, like,
yes.
I can't help but think it's a good idea. So like,
I look on a. You mentioned spreadsheet. Oh, what does it look like on a spreadsheet?
I know.
Yeah, like,
and this is the one thing where my emotions have friction with the spreadsheet.
That's what I think
Do
about.
Do you buy rental properties off of emotions?
Yeah. Oh, no, of emotions. No.
Okay.
No.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, what's the, like, average stock market return? 7%? 7 to 9% or something? I don't know.
Yeah, historically.
Historically, yeah.
So
just say 10% for easy math.
Sure. So 10% for that. So you would be, you know, earning 10% on 50K and then it would compound annually. But if you're able to leverage that 50K into a real estate asset, now you have a $200,000 asset, assuming. And now that $200,000 asset is going to compound by appreciation alone, not to mention all the other benefits that you might get, mm-hmm. cash flow, depreciation, debt pay down. And if you're constantly re-leveraging that, I'm very curious to see a comparison between the two.
If you constantly re-leverage it, I've done these models, and I've sat some stuff like Lon and Charles Roberts. If you re-leverage that, the returns are way better than the stock market because you're going to stay in that 20 to 30% return range a lot of times.
Okay.
If you're you know, optimizing your equity every 3 to 5 years, you're pulling it out, selling and trading up, you have to use your equity. Because the thing here is the stock market, I'm assuming, you know, most people have their dividends just automatically reinvest. It's just automatic, 100% autopilot, which that's something I really like about stock markets. It's just, I look at my accounts like twice a year. But real estate, we don't automatically reinvest because we have to take the cash flow, which is kind of like our dividends, and reinvest that. And you can't reinvest $200 a month in cash flow into real estate property. So it has to sit there for a while until you can get a lot more money or combine with something else. And the same with equity. You have to reinvest your equity to keep those high returns. Otherwise, long-term, it's really fascinating that if you, as you know, you get into like, you know, I say like year 15 or year 10, year 15 plus, and no one quote me on this exact data, a lot of times as real estate gets less and less leveraged and close to paid off, it's very similar returns to stock market. In terms of just, again, depends on appreciation. We're talking historic appreciation, not the craziness we have now.
Yeah.
Depreciation runs out one day.
Yep.
Your debt pay down runs out one day. Like, you start losing a lot of benefits and your returns actually start getting very compressed close to stock market returns. Which begs the question, if you're taking all the risk, I want a better return in real, because real estate is risky to the stock market. You have to deal with people. You have to deal with crap.
Correct.
You can get sued.
Correct. But you can prevent that.
You can mitigate it.
Mitigate. Okay, that's a better word.
And I think it's important.
If you got a lawyer that can prevent that, let me give me his number. I think mitigate's a better word.
But I think it's also important to point out that Ben is a young guy. Like, this would not.
I have time on my side.
Yes, this would not work out if you were, you know, 45, 50,
yep.
I think that's not going to work out because you're in your early 30s. I think that it could go either way, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. And, or what I could do, another is take my Roth IRA, buy a house hack, and then my plan with that house hack that I purchased with that Roth IRA, do the same strategy that Chris mentioned for my house hack number one, which is put it into a multifamily. Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting, this is what we always, you know, I talk about a lot of people, is just like, there's like the spreadsheet, then there's like comfort zone emotions.
Exactly.
Like, you know, it's so interesting. This is just, I'm highlighting differences here. Like, you know, I talked about selling your Avada place one day and your eyes got a little big. They're like, yeah, that's not in the plan, in your comfort zone. In the very first place I bought, when I saw numbers, I was like, yeah, sell it SOB. I don't care. So I had no emotional attachment to it. I talk about transferring $10,000 out of my Roth account for some reason, even though a spreadsheet says it makes sense. My stomach gets butterflies. And that might be from, you know, years of programming of never touch your retirement account, but like, it's just interesting how different emotions hit you. And that's something you have to understand. At all of us have to understand that, like, okay, this is just for some reason, it doesn't work well for me. Not right or wrong, but identify it. Like, yeah.
Yeah. And going back to my main reason is I want to make every dollar work for me as hard as I can. And maybe that's maybe looking on a short term scale, but I look, hey, Roth IRA, 8-10% returns. House hack, 25% return.
Oh, more than that with the leverage you get.
Well, on the four quadrant scale, yeah, but just in general, I remember hearing 25% return. That was my looking at a number spreadsheet perspective of, hey, let's leverage it because, and here's another kick. One last thing. Here's another kick too. It's being with a financial advisor. So now I'm paying for that financial advisor to manage my money, which I could just put it into an S&P 500.
Do you have your Roth IRA with a financial advisor?
Yeah. I did that like don't judge me on this.
I would not, but I would make the move to like, an S&P 500 index fund.
Yes, this was before I knew is I had my expenses.
Because that right there will save you money. Now, that's once you get into like private wealth status, get a hedge fund manager for your empire, a couple decades down the road. But right now, low cost index fund manager.
Okay. That's excellent.
Oh, that cursed me, Ben.
It is, you know what? That was a different time in my life. And like you said, I looked at it and even thought about it two times a year. And this was 2015, 2014 when I started on it.
So here you're right about your thinking, like, hey, the spreadsheet says to repurpose the Roth IRA funds. Like, I'm not running a model on there, but I'm guessing I think that spreadsheet would say that. Is that kind of my mental math says
that's my rough math.
Assuming
as
you're constantly repositioning the equity in your house act, or once you get the money out of the real estate, you have to keep reinvesting it. Like every 5 years, you're repurposing the equity. But then taking one step further back from that, you have two sources of capital, your Roth IRA and your equity. Taking money out of your equity has less opportunity cost in my mind than your Roth IRA. Because a Roth IRA, the money can grow in there tax-free still. And it's already in there. Because once you take it out, you can't put that $50,000 back in there. You can put $6,000 or $7,000 a year now. You can put that back in there. But like once it's out, it's out. So I would, again, lean towards equity first because that has, I think, less tax consequences. And you know, from a pure opportunity cost, if I have to draw $50,000 from one, I would lean towards equity or Roth IRA. How much, Jenny?
I don't know. I think it's just a fascinating concept. You know, it's like Ben and I mentioned. You know, probably when we were chatting before, it's just there's just like that little thing in your brain being like, but you can't. You know, it's not right. So it's just a curious concept to.
And it's not like we didn't grow up doing this type of thing. We grew up buy a house, live in it for 30 years, stay at your job, retire. That's what we grew up.
Yeah.
So that's why it's just an interesting topic.
Yeah.
And to hear two different sides of the story.
The other thing is why I would leave it in the Roth IRA is the Roth continues to stay liquid. Equity in your house is not liquid. And I've always looked at my Roth as like, you know, like a second or third tier savings or, you know, emergency account. The same thing, I can pull out I can pull out my principal if I need to float myself or pay bills or make sure my house doesn't get foreclosed on or, you know, whatever crazy scenario that I come into where, hey, if you lose your job, the economy's crap, you can still pull money out of your Roth IRA for whatever it needs. Your equity, it's good until the lender says, no, you can only pull equity. And that can be based on the conditions. That can be based on the market freezing I did 10 years ago. That can be based on you. I didn't need it, but oh my gosh, I just changed my jobs. Now something tragic happened. I can't get my equity. So that's the thing where I like about staying liquid in the Roth IRA.
That's a good point.
Yeah, so you're saying the Roth IRA is another safety net.
Yep.
And diversifying your portfolio.
Because I know you have like your 6 months in cash reserves.
Yeah. Yep.
And the Roth IRA is kind of like a tier behind that. You know, like, no. Oh, we go through that and just, hey, just everything hits the fan. Like, economy goes, job goes.
Yep.
And, you know, health issues, whatever happens. Like, oh my gosh, that trifecta of just BS happens in life. You can always tap into equity. Or I'm sorry, you can always pull out the Roth.
Yep.
But you can't always tap into equity in your house. People do have their HELOCs get closed.
Yeah.
People do have lines of credits get closed. People say, oh, you can no longer get a loan from me anymore. Like, there's that reality of it too. So keep that in like your kind of risk mitigation portion of your mind.
That's a really good point.
Right now, Chris is winning the debate.
But you do have a traditional. It says you do have a traditional.
I do have my traditional IRA as well.
I mean, that obviously, you know, could also be a last resort situation as well for emergency funds. You'd have to pay taxes and penalty, 10% penalty.
What does that look like? What does that look like again?
So your traditional...
Yeah, for point, like my traditional...
It'd be 10% penalty and then you'd have to pay taxes.
Of what the tax rate is at the time you pull it out. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But
so if you're in a 20% tax bracket, you pay 20% plus a 10% penalty. So if you pull out $100,000, $30,000 goes to Uncle Sam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is there in the event of an emergency too. So, yep.
In my mind, that's the tier after the Roth IRA.
I know, I would have to
But where it gets interesting, actually, I thought about this, like totally going down like off a cliff here with you guys. If it ever came important, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, horrible things happen. Me and my wife's incomes are close to zero or whatever happens, and we're at a near zero tax bracket. I'd probably pull out of a 401k or Roth or a traditional IRA before I pull out my Roth.
Yeah.
Because I'm having less tax burden on there. Oh, that's great. I'm in 5% tax bracket here plus a 10% early penalty fee. I'll pay 15%. Let my Roth keep growing, and you know, hopefully I can get my tax bracket up to a higher point then. So it gets very like...
I never thought of what your current...
I go down some doomsday snares.
That's what got me. That's what helped me convince that house hacking real estate investing back in 2018 was a great idea for my family because here are the safety nets that we have. And I'm a big planner on the what ifs and being very prepared for that because it's something will happen. It's just being ready for it.
Yep.
Cool. Well, I know we're kind of running up against the end of our session here. So this was a really great discussion. Any other nuances or questions you guys want to discuss in the Roth IRA equity? Final talking points, questions on there before I ask a final question to you, Ben?
You definitely, like, I didn't think I'd gain this much value out of this 45-minute conversation we had. And so it definitely
has... Thank you.
I know, and I'm surprised because at the end of it, I'm like, you know what? 100% Roth IRA. It just makes sense. And I still, it's good having that option because I don't need to make that jump right now or that decision right now. I have a couple years to decide and a couple years of
let's see what the market's doing.
Let's see what's going on at the time. And maybe it would be, maybe because right now I'm managing the house hack number one ourselves, but maybe if I put it into a multi-unit, obviously I'll be put under property management. So then that will be less I'll have to worry about and less work I'll have to do.
And that's all these trade-offs that come in the spreadsheet.
That's why I love real estate, because there's the math portion to it and then there's the personal preference emotion portion to it. And nothing is necessarily wrong. That's why I like it.
Yeah.
It's to that person.
Yeah.
So
I've got one more point on your thought of.
Let's hear it.
Another opportunity cost. You pull out your money from your Roth. Let's say you're going to miss out on just 10% annual returns on the stock market. You're pulling out 10%. You borrow the money against your equity on a HELOC right now, you're going to be, say, 4%, probably a little bit lower, say 4%. So your borrowing cost on those sources of capital, one's 4%, which is all a loan if it's a HELOC, or it's 10% and you're using capital. So again, same thing. do I want to take $50,000 from here where I'm going to lose 10% of that return? Or do I want to borrow from here where it's going to be a 3 to 4% opportunity cost?
But wouldn't you have to compare that against the opportunity cost of not buying a real estate asset as well? Like appreciation and all that.
Well, I'm saying if you, I'm assuming you're going to buy the real estate regardless. Okay. I'm saying the source of the capital.
Gotcha.
That's what I was, maybe my, I don't know if my logic may not be 100% there. but yeah, I'm assuming you're buying the real estate, but then to get that $50,000, what's the opportunity cost or the capital cost at $50,000?
Yes.
You'll be losing out on the tax benefits, no liquidity, or losing liquidity and losing a 10% return for that $50,000 go to your house hack, or on your equity in the house, it might be 4 to 5% borrowing cost. So something else to noodle on.
That's good.
I feel like I probably confused you more on that.
No, not at all. You didn't. But I do know I have some immediate actionable things to do after this podcast, which is, why is my Roth IRA being managed by a tax professional, Edwards Jones, when I can just put it into an S&P 500? And because, I mean, they'll do just as fine as some investor will.
I think so. My degree is in financial planning, and that was the reason why I could never like go in the field. I was like, well, I want to put my own money into this, so hard to sell.
That's why I wanted to bring up this topic too, is I know your background.
I mean, that's why I probably have a lot more emotion around it too, because that's been so drilled in my head right. Like high school and years. That's just another interesting thing.
Your graduating class would, yeah.
So, okay, to wrap this up, you get your action items. And so I think a really cool thing to do as this progresses, I mean, let's kind of, as we get closer, let's actually do another scenario, actually plug it into like the spreadsheets, do some return equity analyses, and actually put some numbers on there when it comes time, because that's what you have to do. And, you know, other investors out there, if you guys have questions, scenarios like Ben, reach out to me and Jenny. Like, I mean, we love helping people work on the strategy on here. We got Chelsea and the team help analyze your portfolio as well. So reach out to us. We love having these strategy calls or strategy discussions and show them, hey, here's three scenarios. Here's four scenarios. Let's walk through and figure out the right move for you. So we really enjoy doing that. So if you have questions or strategy help or portfolio questions, reach out to us. You guys can find us at denverinvestmentrealestate.com in the show notes. Ben, thank you. Jenny, thank you. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you.